This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated January 16th, 2015. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's cover story is about surgery rights. Hospitals and doctors gear up for legislative battle over regulated health care versus free market competition. This lead story is by Jason DeBruin, and we find it titled under his column, Medical Battle Heats Up. A subset of North Carolina health care laws could be in for their biggest overhaul since 1993 as lawmakers converge on Jones Street in Raleigh for the long legislative session. These changes could lower costs, at least in the near term, for countless common procedures, benefiting especially those with private health insurance. Supporting the changes are entrepreneurial physicians, particularly those who want to add expensive equipment or perform more surgeries at their offices or physician-owned surgery centers. Although there is momentum for change, the existing laws have a powerful supporter. Hospitals. If any changes happen during this year's session, they will happen despite opposition from the North Carolina Hospital Association and its network of influential lobbyists and political money. Of course, physicians have lobbying money as well, and both sides are poised to spend. The political action committees for both the North Carolina Hospital Association and North Carolina Medical Society, which represents physicians, consistently rank in the top 10 in annual spending, according to the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, which closely tracks political spending. In 2012, the most recent year with comprehensive data, the NCHA ranked third in the state by spending $328,000. The NCMS ranked 7th and spent $314,000. The debate boils down to how a government should approach health care. A vote in favor of keeping existing laws sides with hospitals and indicates a preference to treat health care like a utility or a service seen as important enough to require higher government oversight. A vote to change the laws would view health care from a free market perspective driven by competition, but could lead to neglecting services for the needy and indigent. North Carolina legislatures seem more ready to address health care laws than ever. A Health and Human Services subcommittee has been meeting for nearly 2 years to discuss various changes and appears ready to bring the issue to the forefront during the long session this year. For legislators who care about the high cost of health care that their constituents are dealing with, CON reform is low-hanging fruit to reduce health care costs through increased competition and increased accessibility, says Connie Wilson, a legislator-turned-lobbyist who represents physicians' needs. This summer, lawmakers will discuss Certificate of Need laws, CON, more commonly referred to simply as CON laws or CON laws. At a fundamental level, these laws are intended to coordinate health care services so all North Carolinians have access to the proper care. Ideally, these laws would prevent a situation in which two hospitals just miles apart both build large and expensive cancer centers, for example, but neither provides services for cardiovascular care. These laws bear the Certificate of Need name because health care providers must prove that a geographical area has a need for the services. It is illegal in North Carolina for health care providers to buy a CT scanner or an MRI scanner or even a renal dialysis station without first proving to state regulators that the targeted service area has a need for the service. CON laws in North Carolina cover 25 different services. Only Hawaii, Vermont, and the District of Columbia cover more. In theory, the laws make sense because healthcare services supply would perfectly meet demand. If executed perfectly, every North Carolina community would have the perfect supply of health care services. In practice, however, physician groups argue the laws eliminate open and fair competition, driving up costs and potentially restricting access to care. Furthermore, doctors say hospitals benefit the most and manipulate laws to their unfair advantage. Looking at per capita health care spending gives credence to the physicians' arguments. Although many factors contribute to overall health care costs, a look at health care expenditures per capita by state seems to confirm that those living in states without con laws are paying less. As compiled by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, known as CMS, 7 of the 9 states with the lowest per capita expenditures have no con laws. The 9 states with the highest per capita expenditure all have 6 or more services regulated by Certificate of Need laws. Across the nation, 35 states and D.C. have con laws. These laws in North Carolina have remained essentially unchanged since 1993, with the exception of 2005 when endoscopy rooms were removed as a service requiring a certificate. With that change, 56 new licensed surgery centers with endoscopy procedure rooms have been opened. Endoscopies performed in surgery center settings are reimbursed by Medicare at 58% of the hospital reimbursement rate, resulting in a net savings of $300 million, according to Peter Donaldson, CEO of Digestive Health Specialists. In recent years, con laws have frustrated doctors in operating rooms more than any other venue, another arena covered by the laws, for a couple of reasons. Medical advances have made surgery safer, and surgeons can perform knee or hip replacements or many ear, nose, and throat surgeries in outpatient surgery centers, sometimes called ambulatory surgery centers, also known as ASCs, A-S-C. Because of significantly lower overhead costs compared with full-service hospitals, these surgery centers can not only offer routine procedures for lower costs, but can also generate higher profit margins. For example, Rex Healthcare, a subsidiary of UNC Healthcare, projects a 40% profit margin on a proposed surgery center in northern Wake County, according to documents Rex filed with the Department of Health and Human Services. Outpatient surgical services offered in a freestanding ASIC cost about 40% less than the same procedures performed in hospital settings, according to a collection of estimates. Because con laws cover operating rooms, however, surgeons may not simply band together and build a surgery center. Instead, they must continue to do their operations in hospitals with higher overhead costs or at those surgery centers built in partnership with hospitals. A better option for many physicians, but still not what they really want. To be sure, physicians would be allowed to submit a need-based application to the state. However, based on the state's formula to determine a need, North Carolina won't need any more operating rooms in the near future. In fact, the state's formula shows a surplus of 269 operating rooms in the state through at least 2017. Even at a time when the population in the state continues to boom. Physicians argue that the formula needs to be updated, particularly since hospitals also use procedure rooms, which are separated from official operating rooms only through a technicality, for many surgeries and throw off the formula to determine need. In the Triangle, two of the loudest proponents for the con law changes are Randy Schultz, CEO of North Carolina Specialty Hospital, a private physician-owned medical center in Durham, and Dr. Richard Bruch, an orthopedic surgeon with Triangle Orthopedic Associates, which owns the specialty hospital. The con system, in my opinion, has evolved in an unhealthy manner, Bruch says. He says he understands the rules, but that the system has evolved far from the ideal and gone from placing the right facilities in the right number in the right places to let's protect our certificate of need holders. Schultz cuts more directly to the point. Competition is not as good for hospitals as it is for patients, she says. Competition is good for patients. It's good for you and me. She adds that a con law almost promotes inefficiencies and that it perpetuates a monopoly. They broke up Ma Bell long ago, she says, as a comparison. As a rebuttal, the hospitals say physicians have the luxury to hone in specifically on a con law but can ignore other services that a hospital provides to a community. The North Carolina Specialty Hospital, for example, does not operate an emergency department and is not required to see patients on drug overdose or requiring detox. These services and others drain a hospital's finances because the hospital must treat patients even if they will never receive a penny to cover costs. Health systems argue they need to keep high-margin services to compensate for losses from Medicare, Medicaid, and uncompensated care. Indeed, the Triangle's seven largest hospitals advertised a combined community benefit of $862 million in 2013 alone, meaning they reported incurring that much in unreimbursed costs of care, according to the data compiled by the North Carolina Hospital Association, the group that lobbies for the North Carolina hospitals. If procedures like knee or hip replacements were done outside the hospital and physician-owned surgery centers where doctors made the money, the hospitals would no longer benefit from the high-margin business that helps offset charity care. I wouldn't say benefited, I would say saved. We have to have those procedures to stay open, says Cody Hand, the Hospital Association's Deputy General Counsel, who will lobby heavily against con law changes. It allows us to do those things that our communities need. This argument, while true, ignores a few key points. Nonprofit hospitals like Duke Health, UNC Healthcare, Wake Med Health and Hospitals, and nearly every hospital in the state receive large tax benefits and government reimbursements intended to cover the losses they incur from treating the state's poor and neediest. Conversely, North Carolina Specialty Hospital pays taxes. Even with the uncompensated care, hospitals still make millions. UNC Healthcare, for example, projects an operating income of $50 million this year, a figure that doesn't include income from investments. Last year, the health system made close to $90 million in net income. Duke Health's finances are even better. In the 2013 fiscal year, the hospital reported $295 million in net income, up from $258 million the year prior. Both figures include income from investments. Hand admits these numbers could lead one to believe all hospitals are awash in cash, but he rightly points out that that's only half the story. While major health systems in North Carolina's three largest metros do well, those outside the Triangle, Triad, and Charlotte struggle to turn a profit. It's possible those struggles will continue. The association estimates more than $8 billion in additional cuts in the coming decade, more than half of which stem from the Affordable Care Act. If state lawmakers don't expand Medicaid, it will continue to drag down hospital balance sheets. Health insurance providers have so far stayed mostly on the sidelines, although the outcome will certainly affect them. Lower costs, particularly for elective procedures, would benefit them in the short run, although Hand would argue that the long-term effects could raise prices for other services. More importantly, health insurers benefit from increased competition. Providers and insurers negotiate reimbursement rates for all services. With more competition, individual providers have less bargaining strength against insurers who can threaten to exclude providers from their networks. Trying to guess how lawmakers will act is a fool's errand, but there seems to be more movement in that direction than in any year, except maybe 2005. Representative Marilyn Avila, a Republican representing Northern Wake County, introduced bills to change the laws last year and will make recommendations this year to revisit changes, particularly around operating rooms. One suggestion might be to deregulate single specialty operating rooms in which doctors could perform only a narrow set of surgeries, a change not unlike what happened in 2005. Having taken the temperature of her colleagues, Avila says there is a growing list of legislators who are gaining a knowledge of the issues and would be willing to vote on a bill. But nothing will happen too fast. It's one of those things that people are going to have to take a good bit of time with, she says. Wilson, the lobbyist who spent nearly 14 years representing Mecklenburg County and now represents the North Carolina Orthopedic Association, says this is the year to see law changes come to fruition. He says, she says, excuse me, there is never any way to guarantee that a bill will pass, but certificate of need reform has never had the level of support that it has in 2015. Next up, small business. This column is written by James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His column is entitled, How Family Businesses Can Learn from 2014. It's January, time for family businesses to do their year-end wrap-ups, which provide a review of and a reflection on how the year has gone in both business and family terms. The review involves opening up the records and looking at the performance of the company and key family and non-family executives and employees. This isn't just a profit and loss appraisal or a shape-up session for the end of the tax year. These are crucial performance assessments for any business. The year-end review for family businesses also asks how much stronger the company is at this year's end than last. How did the corporate strategy serve the family's needs and aspirations? What business activities brought the family in closer contact with its community? The year-end review can spotlight some dimensions of the family business's life that often gets lost in the rush at other times of the year. The review also takes in account how well the people in the company performed, supported the business's mission, and upheld the family's values. The reflection part of the exercise is important, too. If the review looks at what happened during the year, the reflection considers how and why it happened. Some of the conclusions will be data-based. The company's bottom line improved by 15% because we sold that fleet of trucks to the county. But a lot of how and why will be judgment-based. The business picked up momentum this year because we finally got our heads around the family and business mission statement and made part of it our working style. The year-end reflection might produce a couple of downers, too. Mom's death has taken the wind out of our sails this year. Or Bill's still trying to sort through the responsibility of running the company, so succession has had a few rough moments. Or the year's growth spurt has pulled us away from our sense of family heritage that's been ingrained in the business since Granddad started it. Until the family in business pauses to take a thoughtful look at how well the business has met its needs and sustained its values, there's a real risk that distractions and misdirections won't be noticed. If they're not noticed, they won't be corrected. Someday, or evening, soon, gather the family around the table. Get out the year's facts and figures and give them a full review and careful reflection. Work on it until everyone's comfortable with how the business and the family have performed and why. Then get ready for another year's challenges, opportunities, and rewards. This week's column by Amanda Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. Her lead article covers the Dix purchase lauded by supporters. Before the North Carolina governor and Raleigh mayor could even take the podium at the executive mansion to announce their $52 million deal, terms for the 308-acre Dorothea Dix campus, there was already a group of Raleigh business leaders nearly dancing a jig in the bright television camera lights. Leading the group was Greg Poole, Jr., the visionary behind the influential Dix Visionary Group that was formed for the purpose of advocating for the Dix campus to be turned into a destination recreational park for Raleigh, not a site for commercial and residential development. Poole was diligent in his recruitment of Raleigh-area influencers and decision-makers for Dix Visionaries, a guest list that includes Jim Goodman of Capital Broadcasting, Ann Goodnight of SAS, former DHHS official Lucy Bode, and former CP&L President, CEO, and Chairman Sherwood Smith, who were all in attendance Monday at the Dix deal announcement. Poole also assembled an unlikely coalition of big land and property developers to advocate for Dix campus park status, including O. Temple Sloan Jr. of General Parts, Ed Fritch of Highwood Properties, and Raleigh land developer Carlton Midyet. The group secured more than $3 million in pledged donations to finance the planning for the park. The group members gathered to celebrate with a lunch at 18 Seaboard in downtown Raleigh afterwards. "It's a fantastic day," said Sloan after the announcement. Sloan, like many others, joined Dix Visionaries because Poole, the former president of the Gregory Poole Equipment Company, asked him to, and because he believed the campus could become a destination for residents and visitors in Raleigh, much like Central Park is for New York City. Also, Carolina Ale House opens flagship in Glenwood South. The Raleigh-based owner and operator of the Carolina Ale House Sports Bar and Restaurant Group has been busy putting the finishing touches on what will be its new flagship restaurant in the heart of downtown Raleigh's Glenwood South District. The new Carolina Ale House at 500 Glenwood Avenue opened to the public for lunch January 12th, according to a spokesperson for LM Restaurants, the owner of the Carolina Ale House chain. The new restaurant occupies all of the top floor of the three-story building that's between the 510 Glenwood Retail Office and Condo Building and the Creamery Building Retail and Office Building at the corner of Glenwood Avenue and Tucker Street. The building also has space for additional restaurant and retail concepts, but owner Lou Moshekos has not disclosed his plans for those spaces yet. LM Restaurants on December 31st closed the original Carolina Ale House location on Creekside Drive in Raleigh in preparation for the Glenwood South restaurant opening. On the hospitality side of things, in Amanda Hoyle's column of commercial and residential real estate, there's a new 12-story hotel planned for downtown Raleigh. A hotel developer has submitted plans for the city to rezone a piece of property within the Prince Hall Historic District in downtown Raleigh for a hotel and office building that could stand as high as 12 stories. The hotel would be next to the McDonald's restaurant building at the corner of Wilmington and Lenore Streets, across from the construction site for the 11-story Charter Square office building, and near the campus of Shaw University. The site currently has a small office building that serves as the headquarters for the General Baptist State Convention of North Carolina, and it is expected that the Baptist Convention would relocate into the offices of the new building. But neither Devin Patel, a director with the Huntsville-based Narcy Properties Hotel Development Group that submitted the rezoning request, nor Reverend Haywood Gray with the Baptist Convention returned calls for comment. Derek Scales of Winston-Salem, co-owner of the two 1900s-era houses on Lenore Street that must be moved or torn down to the hotel site, stated he did not want to comment for this report. Andy Andrews, developer of the Charter Square office building, says he welcomes the hotel project. Downtown needs more rooms, he says. I'm totally supportive of it. We want to see Wilmington Street improve and become more vibrant. About two blocks away, Raleigh-based Summit Hospitality is also expected to break ground this spring on its new Residence Inn by Marriott Hotel that will be either 9 or 10 stories tall with street-level retail and a rooftop lounge. It will be connected to the existing Performing Arts parking deck that's bound by Lenore, South Street, and Salisbury Streets. The Narcy Properties Hotel property site, however, is within the boundaries of the Prince Hall Historic District, which would require special approval from the city to demolish or relocate the buildings on the site. Narcy Properties in December hosted a neighborhood meeting for adjacent property owners. Patel's land use attorney, Mac Paul of Morningstar Law Group, says the hotel will be branded with a national flag, but he would not disclose which national hotel company or brand. We're now following Jason DeBrun's column. Jason covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. His lead article this week is the Argos drug trial, Good News, Bad News. Durham drug developer Argos Therapeutics saw its share price plunge 32% after it did not meet the primary endpoint of an HIV trial. Argos, which is in the process of building a major manufacturing facility in Durham, tested its therapy in patients chronically infected with HIV-1, but reported January 9th that the therapy did not reduce the viral infection enough to meet the goal. Shares closed for the week at $6.51, down from the previous day's close of $9.61. The report wasn't without some positive takeaways. The Argos therapy extracts cells from a patient, manipulates them using its proprietary Arcellus platform, and injects them back into the patient. At that point, these cells, called dendritic cells, act as sort of a teacher to the patient's own immune system and trains the body to attack the disease. Argos CEO Jeff Abbey pointed out that despite not reaching the primary endpoint, the trial showed that 70% of patients who received the therapy called AGS-004 had specific positive antiviral responses. None of the patients in the placebo group showed this response. Dr. Charles Nicolet, the Chief Scientific Officer and Vice President of R&D at Argos, is quoted as saying, "These data support our plans to continue testing AGS-004 in the studies aimed at decreasing or eliminating the latent HIV reservoir. In addition, based on these data, we believe that more frequent dosing of AGS-004 during ART, standard antiretroviral therapy, provide for future benefit, but also highlight the need to better understand the mechanisms of immune evasion employed by the HIV virus in the absence of ART." Next up, Rex Healthcare names Burris interim president. Rex Healthcare appointed Chief Operating Officer Steve Burris as interim president. He fills in for David Strong, who took a position as CEO of Orlando Health. Although Strong plans to stay with the hospital system through March, Burris's appointment is effective immediately. For the past few years, Strong had already transitioned from a Rex-centric role to one that oversees all of UNC Healthcare's system affiliations. Rex, off of Blue Ridge Road in Raleigh, is a subsidiary of UNC Healthcare. Burris, 48, has served as Chief Operating Officer at Rex since April 2012. He oversees all operations at the 660-bed hospital and its outlying facilities. The hospital has 5,600 employees. Prior to his role as COO, Burris served as Senior Vice President of Operations and Ambulatory Services, managing services including Rex Cancer Center, Heart and Vascular Services, Physician Services, and Ambulatory Services. During Burris's tenure, Rex added 3 new health campuses, 2 joint venture surgery centers, and more than 150 physicians. Here's a big number, $140 million. Chapel Hill-based drug developer Sempra Incorporated will look to raise nearly $140 million in a secondary public offering to work on an experimental antibiotic-resistant pneumonia treatment. Importantly, the announcement did not result in a drop in share price despite the 15% share dilution. Shortly before that announcement, Sempra shares popped 7% after the drug developer reported positive Phase 3 trial results for its pneumonia treatment. The secret sauce for Sempra's drugs under development is its ability to fight antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Antibiotic resistance has been called one of the world's most pressing public health problems by organizations like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the World Health Organization, and others. And here's a crossover between healthcare and sports. A group has started a petition, to name the press box in the Dean Smith Center after Stuart Scott, the ESPN broadcaster who died January 4th after a battle with cancer. Although several people at UNC think it is fitting to honor Scott in some way, the athletics department might not be so quick to make this specific move. Although he is a graduate of UNC and spoke fondly of the university and its athletics, Scott never worked out of the press box or covered UNC teams with any regularity. Naming the press box after Scott would be somewhat out of the ordinary for this kind of honor. For example, the radio booth at Keenan Stadium is named for Woody Durham, who became known to many as the voice of the Tar Heels after calling football and basketball games for 4 decades. Similarly, the media room at Duke Cameron Indoor Stadium is named for Bill Brill, a longtime Duke sport historian. Brill at one point covered 111 consecutive Duke-UNC games and 125 such matchups in total. In both those cases, the facility is named in honor of a person who spent countless hours working in that very area. On a grander scale, both the Dean Smith Center and Cameron Indoor Stadium are named for coaches who spent years with their respective universities. Although he became a famous broadcaster for the nation's largest sport networks, Scott never worked at UNC. In internal conversations, athletics and university officials discussed that an honor or at the School of Journalism, from which Scott graduated in 1987, might be more appropriate. Officially, university officials said that no decision has been made, though discussions were happening. We move now to Lauren Onisorge. She covers technology and entrepreneurship. Her lead article in her column is Protecting the Brand. Durham-based Cree files patent infringement suits against competitor. LED giant Cree doesn't plan to sit out 2015. Days after announcing a new $500 million line of credit, the Durham company went on the offensive, filing federal complaints alleging that a competing firm, California-based Fight Electric Company, has infringed on 10 of its patents. That means Cree is making moves to protect its intellectual property, even as it bulks up with a cash haul that could mean an acquisition in Cree's 2015. Cree, which hasn't made a major acquisition since the $525 million stock and cash deal for Rudd Lightning in 2011, used part of the proceeds from the new credit line to repay amounts outstanding under a previous agreement with Wells Fargo. But there's a caveat for the rest, according to the securities filings, that additional loans could be used for working capital or future acquisitions. The credit agreement matures January 9, 2020. As of September 28th, Cree had $150 million in an unsecured revolving line of credit set to mature August 12, 2017. Under that agreement, the company had a $45 million outstanding amount and a $105 million available to borrow. Additionally, the company had $196.3 million in cash and cash equivalents, according to its last quarterly report. At that time, Cree reported a revenue of $427.7 million, missing the consensus estimate of $432.6 million, though up 9.4% from the same quarter the previous year. And acquisition or no acquisition, Cree sent a signal that it's going to defend its intellectual property. In papers filed with both the U.S. International Trade Commission and the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin against Fight and its Asian supplier, Unity Opto Technology Company, Cree requests that the ITC issue an order to exclude infringing and falsely advertised articles from entering the United States. The filings include a request for a cease and desist order that would keep Fight from selling certain bulbs stateside. Cree fully supports competition, but it should be fair competition, says Chuck Swoboda, CEO of Cree, via prepared statement. He's quoted as saying, "We have invested nearly $1 billion in R&D over the past 10 years to create fundamental technology that has enabled the LED lighting revolution. With more than 4,000 issued patents, we have an obligation to protect our shareholders and our licensing partners." End quote. In fiscal 2014 alone, the company inked $181.4 million in research and development costs, according to the securities filings. LED lighting was the biggest growth driver. Cree reported $1.6 billion in revenue for 2014. Of that, $833.7 million, or 51%, was in LED products. And e-commerce firm predicts a revenue shortfall. Morrisville-based e-commerce software firm Channel Advisor predicts bad news in February. The company, which develops a dashboard that helps online retailers sell their wares on multiple platforms, is lowering its fourth quarter guidance. Instead of expected revenue between $25.6 million and $26.1 million, the expectation is $23.7 million. CEO Scott Wingo blames the shift on the acquisition of larger customers. Because larger customers enjoy volume discounts in the form of lower take rates, this shift translated to lower variable subscription revenue, he says, adding that gross merchandise volume increased 31% year over year in the quarter. Despite this, we believe our fundamental value proposition, position in the market, and opportunities for continued growth remain intact. On January 13th, the company's stock had plummeted more than 52% to trade at $9.83, near the 52-week low of $9.03. Compare that to the 52-week high of $49.90. Highwood Properties goes mobile with a new app for the phone. Highwood has just gone mobile, teaming up with a mobilesmith to release an app that helps manage its property portfolio. The partnership is for a platform that will allow Highwoods to design, build, launch, and manage apps. No programmers are required. The app is available for Apple and Android devices. The first app is a native app for the Alliance Center properties in Atlanta that will allow tenants to navigate the buildings easily, as well as to reserve meeting rooms and submit service requests. Highwoods owns two Alliance Center buildings just north of downtown Atlanta. The buildings' combined space contains more than 1 million square feet. Should the app prove valuable for tenants, Highwoods could develop more applications for other properties. The agreement includes 3 live apps and unlimited prototypes and test builds. On the entrepreneur side of Lauren Onisorge's column, North Carolina State University is to embed students in startups. Trying to take your venture to the next level? A new NC State University initiative in downtown Raleigh could take on your startup challenges cost-free. That's according to Lewis Sheets, senior lecturer in entrepreneurship at North Carolina State's Poole College of Management. He's directing the Entrepreneurship Clinic, an outreach of the university's The Entrepreneurship Collaborative. The project is supported and funded through the Poole Endowment, and Sheets expects corporate and individual support to grow the clinic. The initiative, which kicks off at HQ Raleigh in February, aims to give North Carolina entrepreneurs, not just those located at HQ, access to technology commercialization experts who already consult with companies and universities across the globe. That includes faculty, whose research focuses on entrepreneurship, as well as NC State students in various academic programs across the campus. Sheets, who says the university has been in talks to create an actual physical space to embed within the community, picked downtown because of its access to tech firms. HQ just made a lot of sense for us because they already had the database of companies students can work with, he says. An interested startup would contact the team and tell its entrepreneurship story. They tell us what they're working on, and then we would direct it to the right student or group of students or faculty, and then we could work on it, he says. If it's a market development or business development type project, then we would put students from the College of Management on that type of project. The initiative gives students real-world experience and contacts. We really want our students to be better prepared to go to work in the startup community, he says. We need to create an experience for them so they can see what does it really take to do it. This initiative will cost less than $100,000 annually to run, says Sheets. This week's 9 to 5 column includes news and tidbits about small and family-owned businesses in the Triangle. Lord Corp celebrates 90th anniversary in business. Cary-based Lord Corporation, manufacturer of adhesives, coatings, motion management devices, and sensing technologies, recently celebrated 90 years in business. At its inception, Lord had a staff of 6. Today, the company has more than 3,000 employees in 26 countries. A series of global 90th birthday celebrations concluded at Lord Corp's world headquarters in Cary. Plus, Sassoul establishes a Wake Tech Culinary Scholarship. Sassoul Cafe, Bakery and Market, and owner Munir Salih have established the Sassoul Culinary Arts Scholarship with the Wake Tech Foundation. The scholarship will assist a full-time, second-year student pursuing a culinary arts degree at Wake Tech Community College. It's about giving back, Salih says. Kids are our future. This scholarship is a way to help one achieve his or her goal. Sassoul is a family-owned cafe, bakery, and market serving Lebanese and Mediterranean cuisine in a fast, casual setting on Strickland Road in Raleigh. It was formerly known as Neomond, but was renamed last year to honor Munir's mother, whose name is Cecilia. Sassoul is Celia's nickname from childhood. Plus, Raleigh Garden Center receives national accolades. Atlantic Avenue Orchard and Garden on Atlantic Avenue in Raleigh has been awarded Revolutionary 100 Garden Center by Today's Garden Center magazine and named a Top 100 Independent Garden Center by Garden Center magazine. Garden Center Magazine's Top 100 is based primarily on revenue, while today's Garden Centers Award recognizes the most innovative retail garden centers based on customer and community service, marketing, use of technology, purchasing, and profitability. And Lurio Engineering opens first North Carolina office in Raleigh. Lurio Engineering Associates Incorporated, with headquarters in Plainville, Connecticut, has opened its first North Carolina office in Raleigh at 4208 Six Forks Road, Suite 1000. Kevin Levisk, a professional engineer with more than 12 years' experience, is the first employee in the Raleigh office. Levisk will provide clients with environmental compliance support and engineering solutions for industrial manufacturing processes, wastewater treatment systems, and remediation systems. Lurio has offices in Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Rhode Island, and Washington, D.C. This week's issue of Triangle Business Journal includes the 2015 economic forecast, sunny with a chance of afternoon showers. Although the 2015 business outlook looks mostly sunny, it's not without a few clouds or even a rainstorm here or there. Economists gave a largely upbeat perspective at the 2015 Economic Forecast Forum hosted by the Raleigh Chamber of Commerce, but also highlighted a few danger spots. Personal income sources. Wages and salaries now make up less than 47% of all personal income sources, down more than half a percent point from 2010. In decades past, that figure has been well above 50% and even as high as 55% in the 1980s. This is a concern because it could signal a continued class divide as those in higher income brackets generate more income from investments, while middle class earners rely on wages and salaries that are not keeping up. In addition, an income source that economists refer to as transfers, which includes sources like Social Security, stood at 16% last year, up from 11% and 12% for the latter part of the last millennium. I think it's a concern, Wells Fargo security economist Michael Brown says. There are some social aspects that are very concerning. And the North Carolina unemployment still fails to rebound to pre-recession levels. Also, some of the concern is a look at employment as a percentage of the entire population. The unofficial employment number has been dropping, but that measures employment only as a percentage of those people who are actively looking for work. When comparing employment as a percentage of the entire population, employment has not rebounded to pre-recession levels, indicating that people are still waiting on the sidelines and not getting back into the workforce. Most of the data provided held a positive outlook for 2015. However, I think the key takeaway for 2015 is we are looking for much stronger growth, not only in the U.S., but here in Raleigh and North Carolina, says Brown. I think it's a good year to expand. I would put this year probably in one of the stronger years that we are going to have this decade. We see some risk toward the end of the year as we head into 2016, but this year should be a good year to expand. And that's the 2015 economic forecast, according to the Triangle Business Journal. This week's Viewpoint guest column is written by Amish Patel. Mr. Patel is a Raleigh lawyer. His subject is cybersecurity, and the title of his column is Tackling the Complex World of Cybersecurity. In the data privacy and cybersecurity world, 2014 started off the same way as it ended. In early 2014, Target was recovering from one of the largest data breaches in cybersecurity history. The negative publicity and harm to its reputation certainly took a toll on its business and cost the company close to $150 million. Now, Sony Pictures is in the spotlight suffering from a cyber attack by a group of hackers who gained access to confidential information. Unfortunately, this is not the first for Sony. The Sony PlayStation Network was breached in 2011, causing a complete outage of the PlayStation Network for more than 20 days. Sandwiched in between Target and Sony Pictures were other household names such as The Home Depot and Staples. Each of these companies incurred significant cost and underwent drastic efforts to remedy the security breaches. Additionally, the companies must earn back the public's trust after suffering the most significant harm of all, reputational damage. Cybersecurity legislation is now at the top of the agenda for state and federal governments. Just before the 113th Congress concluded its final session in 2014, it passed 6 pieces of legislation to address cybersecurity. Unfortunately, only one of these pieces of legislation, the National Cybersecurity Protection Act of 2014, known as NCPA, remotely applies to the private sector. The rest of the legislation merely modernizes the federal government's cybersecurity infrastructure and provides the necessary resources and funding needed to support its cybersecurity infrastructure. The NCPA codifies the pre-existing Department of Homeland Security's National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center, which is an interface between the federal government and private sector to share cybersecurity risks, technical analysis, and threat information. The impact of the NCPA is unclear, but it is safe to say that Congress needs to do more when it comes back to session in 2015. What's missing in all of this legislation is a federal breach notification standard for the private sector, more robust information sharing interfaces between federal intelligence agencies and the private sector, and immunity for private companies sharing threat information with the federal government. Instead of waiting for governments to take the lead, CEOs of companies should take the heed of the large-scale data breaches and assess their own cybersecurity efforts. Preventive measures can certainly save companies significant remediation costs in the end. These measures include assessing the company's current infrastructure, analyzing the risk in the current infrastructure, and minimizing known risk using technology and business process solutions. These efforts are sure to minimize risk, but cannot eliminate it. Having a plan of action in place when a cybersecurity threat occurs is also prudent. There are numerous action items a company needs to take once a threat occurs. These include assessing the breach, locking down the affected systems, sending out breach notifications, properly handling public relations campaigns, and cooperating and coordinating with law enforcement and government agencies. It took a whole year of cybersecurity threats and data breaches to get this issue pushed to the forefront. The reality is that cybersecurity threats can happen to any business regardless of the size. C-suite executives should make cybersecurity a top priority in 2015. This week's editor notebook is by Sukhadar Mukherjee, who is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. His column is entitled, Mayor, Executives Stepped Up Their Game. Well done, Raleigh. You made it happen. It took you months, as it should, and in the end, you did it not because of the present, but because of the future. The 308-acre Dorothy Dix property in downtown Raleigh has entered the final stages of a $52 million sale that will transfer the ownership of the property from North Carolina to Raleigh. The capital city wants to turn the giant property into a public park. Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarland and NC Governor Pat McCrory have signed the term sheet, but hurdles remain. McCrory's Council of State must approve the deal, and the North Carolina General Assembly must remain on the sidelines. Although even if some lawmakers make noise about the unfairness of the deal, those voices are expected to be muted. With an election year not too far away, McCrory will quash any such dissension before he is forced to veto such a deal. But that's negative chatter. Let's focus on the positives. Long-term Raleigh business executives such as Gregory Poole Jr., O. Temple Sloan, Carlton Midyet, and Ed Fritch joined hands with local community stalwarts Ann Goodnight, Sherwood Smith, and Lucy Bodie to push the sale. They were incessant, deliberate, and sometimes vociferous. They talked to lawmakers, they talked to the governor, and they met with lawyers. They knew it would be tough for McFarland to close the deal all by herself. She needed some heavyweights on her side pushing the agenda, solidifying the narrative. After all, money and influence often overpower most ideologies. This is a big deal. The people who pushed the deal and the city staff that structured the terms will not benefit from this deal. It will benefit their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. In so many ways, that makes this grand. On a personal level, this deal was more satisfying than anything I have ever done, says Tom McCormick, Raleigh city attorney. Big words coming from a person who's been at his current job for about 38 years. I suspect folks on the other side, former State Budget Director Art Pope, McCrory, North Carolina Department of Administration Secretary Bill Daughtridge, will be glad they were part of the deal when they look back a few years from now. For folks living in rural areas, parks, open space, and clean air are the norm. Not so much at urban centers where companies want to move, jobs are created, and infrastructure is under assault. It's a global problem. Read up on the history of cities such as Beijing, Mexico City, and Lagos, Nigeria. You will get my point. For now, we don't have to worry about that. We took the first step. Again, well done, Raleigh. This week's column, People on the Move, spotlights Mr. Brad Davis. Mr. Davis is the executive director of the WakeMed Foundation. Describing it as his dream job, Brad Davis now takes the reins of the WakeMed Foundation, serving as its executive director. In this role, Davis will be charged with providing leadership and vision to all aspects of the foundation's work. He's also responsible for working to ensure that all giving to the foundation is invested in the most impactful and efficient manner, he says. Mr. Davis is quoted as saying, serving as executive director of the WakeMed Foundation is an incredible opportunity and one where we can have an impact on many lives. The Triangle Business Journal asked him some questions. The first one is, what is one thing you wish people knew about your job? Mr. Davis replies, I wish people could see firsthand the difference our donors make each day and every day in the lives of those who need us. Triangle Business Journal asks, what are some of your major goals in this position? And Mr. Davis replies, we have had amazing success through the years supporting the work of the hospital and expanding its ability to serve the community. It is my intention to build upon that success and take us to even greater heights. The health and well-being needs of our area continue to grow at a rapid rate. The foundation is in an incredible position to address those needs as never before. We have an inspired and committed team of volunteers and donors that love WakeMed and our community. The Triangle Business Journal asks Mr. Davis, what's your biggest pet peeve? And he replies, my biggest pet peeve is apathy. If you have an issue or challenge that is on your mind, do something about it. Be part of the solution. The Triangle Business Journal asks Mr. Davis, what's your biggest worry? And he said, my biggest worry is that we are not doing enough to ensure the children of our generation have all the support and resources they need to build a bright future. The TBJ asked, Triangle business person you most admired, and Mr. Davis replied, my biggest hero is Temple Sloan Jr. He does so much for so many and is a model of an effective and engaged leader. The list of his accomplishments and initiatives is endless, yet he is such a humble and gracious person. Mr. Davis is married to Leslie, has three boys, Jack, Joe, and Harry, and the last book he read was The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. You should know that Duke Health has named a new CEO from UCLA. Duke University tapped Dr. A. Eugene Washington as Chancellor for Health Affairs and the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Duke University Health System. He replaces Dr. Victor Zhao, who held the role for nearly a decade and left last summer to become the next president of the Institute of Medicine. Duke President Richard Broadhead is quoted as saying, Gene Washington has a track record of outstanding leadership in every aspect of the work of an academic medical center, research, education, and patient care. A gifted communicator, he has special skills at getting people to work together in support of the larger mission. He has been at the forefront of the national effort to make patient outcomes the focus of healthcare, and he is a champion of community health who will bring that commitment to Durham. I'm delighted to have him join the Duke team. Mr. Washington, age 64, currently serves as Vice Chancellor for Health Services, Dean of the David Geffen School of Medicine, and Chief Executive Officer of the UCLA Health System, where he is also a Distinguished Professor of Gynecology and Health Policy. Also, Morrisville Chamber's Chief has stepped down. Carlotta Ungaro, president of the 350-member Morrisville Chamber of Commerce, has announced that she will be stepping down from her position on January 30th to accept a leadership position with the Fayetteville County Chamber of Commerce near Atlanta. Ungaro has been with the Morrisville Chamber since May 2011. During her time in the Triangle, she helped launch the Morrisville Innovation Foundation, a public-private partnership that helps match funds with the state's One North Carolina grant program to attract new and expanding companies that create jobs in Morrisville and to help support startup endeavors. "We hate to lose Carlotta," says Morrisville Chamber Board Chair Vanessa Jenkins of Preston Development. During her short tenure, Carlotta's pursuit of improving the business climate in Morrisville has made strides that will be seen and felt for years to come. "She truly is the driving force that has taken our chamber to the next level. Carlotta will be greatly missed." And McConnell Golf buys an Asheville course. McConnell Golf finalized its acquisition of the Country Club of Asheville, giving the company a new westernmost property. Financial terms of the acquisition were not released, though John McConnell, founder and CEO of the company, committed to investing $4 million in improvements, including to both the clubhouse and the course. The Asheville course gives McConnell its first mountain course and becomes the 11th course under the McConnell name. Members of any McConnell course may play at any of the other courses as well, and McConnell has said he wanted to add a course out west so members from Raleigh would have an option if they vacationed in the mountains. Mr. McConnell is quoted as saying, "Given how difficult it can be to find the right club, golf course, and club culture within a most desired region of a state, a lot of things have to go right and the planets have to align," he said after closing the deal. "These all certainly came into order with our latest edition of our long-awaited mountain course, designed by none other than Donald Ross." Founded in 1894, the Asheville Club lays claim to being the oldest private club in the state, but Cape Fear Country Club in Wilmington also claims that title. We've run out of time for this edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.